Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, UCSB student reporter Zoha Malik spoke to grad students who are part of a group called Researchers Against War.
Out of the top five defense companies in the world, UCSB has gotten the most grant money from these five corporations.
Also, KCBX's Tom Wilmer met with Faith Morris at the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee.
It was a phenomenal institution all along, but we wanted to make it more immersive. We also wanted to make sure that slavery was the first experience, because we really felt that slavery was the early instance of civil rights infringements.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, January 13th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with a summary of new laws going into effect in California this year.
This is the California Report. I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles. Let's start with the new laws that affect the workplace. Whether you work 9 to 5 or other hours, as of January 1st, the minimum wage for California workers is now $16.50 an hour. That's a 50-cent increase that's pegged to the Consumer Price Index. But keep in mind, some California cities already have higher minimum wages, as do some industries like fast food and healthcare. Another new workplace law, titled the California Worker Freedom from Employer Intimidation Act, prohibits bosses from requiring employees to attend meetings about politics or religion. The law also protects employees from having to hear the boss's views on unions or union organizing efforts. And another new workplace law prohibits employers from requiring job applicants to have a valid driver's license when applying for a position, unless driving is necessary for the gig. Let's turn now to new laws in education. A new law prohibits private colleges and universities in California that receive state funding from considering a prospective student's connection to alumni or donors in deciding whether that student gets in. The law was authored by Democratic Assemblymember Phil Ting, who says it's a way to prevent wealthy families from having an unfair advantage in the college admissions process.
This is like the 1% of Americans, and the fact that they have complete access, they have a back door, they have a side door, they have an express lane into our most elite institutions, and that if they choose to continue that practice, that the state will no longer subsidize them through their Cal Grant process.
The University of California system eliminated alumni and donor preferences in admissions in 1998. Moving to K-12 education, a new law prohibits teachers and school staff from disclosing information about students' gender identity or sexual orientation without the student's consent. LGBTQ advocates say it's a way to help protect students from harm, including at home. But conservative groups say the law steps on parental rights and authority and have vowed to fight it. And when it comes to traffic safety, a new law makes it illegal to park within 20 feet of marked or unmarked crosswalks in California. It's supposed to make it easier for pedestrians and drivers to see each other, says Jeremy Bloom, a street safety advocate who spoke to San Diego's CBS News 8.
Over the last 10 years, more and more pedestrians have been getting killed on our streets. And this is a really simple, cost-effective way to ensure that folks can get to where they're going safely.
Okay, now new laws that involve emerging technologies and one that's at the intersection of artificial intelligence and fame, like these people.
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
It's a terrible thing to be lonesome, especially in the middle of a crowd.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Those were the genuine voices of the late Sidney Poitier, Marilyn Monroe, and Marlon Brando. A new state law prohibits digital cloning of deceased performers' voices and likenesses for commercial purposes without the express permission of their estates. A related new law allows still living actors to back out of contracts if vague language might allow studios to recreate the performers digitally for future projects. And let's end on an amusement park assortment of other new laws for 2025. One law allows California cannabis retailers to sell food and beverages and offer live entertainment pending local government approval. Another new law prohibits public libraries from banning books that deal with issues of race, gender, or sexual orientation. See that, Florida? And finally, there's even a new law for a creature of the deep that used to get an unnecessary bad rap.
This is the giant devilfish. Feared and avoided for centuries. Subject of fable and folklore. The octopus.
A new law prohibits the raising of octopus for human consumption in the state. That's partly because of the greater understanding we now have of the marine animal's intelligence, problem-solving abilities, and capacity for long-term memory. Octopus and all, those are just some of your new California laws for 2025.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, I spoke to KCBX's Frank Lanzone and Greg Perry about the Live Oak Music Festival. The Live Oak Music Festival has been a part of San Luis Obispo since 1989. It's happening from June 13th to the 15th, 2025, but tickets go on sale next week on January 20th. I am talking with two people today that are part of the core group that has helped organize it. Frank Lanzone has been president and general manager of KCBX since 1980. Greg Perry has been a development director since 2009. Welcome to both of you. How long does it take to put Live Oak together, and what has been each of your roles in it?
Okay. It takes about 12 years to put together every single Live Oak Music Festival, or so it seems. But we literally start working on it in late December, early January. We're already ramping up planning and some of the preliminary work that we need to do. My role has been to kind of be the overseer of the festival. When it first started, it was 99.9% volunteers who did all of the work for the first few festivals. And as it grew, we had to... The dollars increased and the liability increased, and so more staff became involved. But primarily, it's run by a bunch of very dedicated, wonderful people who are volunteers.
Okay.
And just to clarify, I am retired from the development position at KCBX, but I work on special projects, including Live Oak. So I'm happy to do that. Like Frank said, it starts early November, December of the year before the festival. We start looking for artwork that's going to represent the festival, which we're in the planning stages now, and we're really excited to announce our artwork soon in the next couple of weeks. People will be able to see that. So a lot of planning early on.
The festival is going to go live in June. Can you talk to us about what you do when the festival goes live?
Well, quite a bit. Actually, I have a couple of roles, main roles, that I take on. One is the mercantile manager, which is the store that we have where people can shop for merchandise, Live Oak branded, and our silent auction, things like that. So I'm involved in setting that up and getting volunteers for that. I'm also involved in the ticketing system that we use. So all the online ticketing I take care of. And I'm the volunteer coordinator as well, which is a relatively new role for me, but it's a very exciting role because we have about 600 volunteers to manage.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is.
Do you manage all of them?
Oh, no. We have a number of coordinators that help us, that have been helping us for years. It's a wonderful crew of volunteer coordinators who are assigned different areas of responsibility.
Frank, why did the Live Oak Festival start, and what was the intention behind it?
When we started it, we had been doing jazz. The morning music show used to be Morning Cup of Jazz, and now it's a more eclectic show. But we would have every summer free live jazz concerts.
This is when?
Before 1989. We had every summer jazz music concerts in the park, and at some point I talked to our then morning host and music director Chris O'Connell and said, why don't we have concerts for all our other kinds of music? Because we had Morning Cup of Jazz, but we also have folk music and bluegrass and blues and country, and none of those were represented in what was pretty much something we gave back to the community by providing these free concerts every summer. And he said, yeah, okay, and went out and started talking to different people in the community, and at some point they came back in and said, here's what we'll do. And they put together the first concert. It was actually a one-day concert at Biddle Park in Arroyo Grande. And that was the birth of the festival. The next year, it was in Santa Barbara County, and it was for 3 days.
What was the name of the person you said who went out into the community to ask for feedback?
Chris O'Connell. He was our music director and host of Morning Cup of Jazz. He went out and started talking to people, and it just grew into a group of, they were all KCBX supporters and listeners. Some of them were volunteers. It also included Chris Anderson, who was our assistant general manager at the time, who also was part of developing the crew and how the festival would develop.
Greg, who has been your favorite artist at the festival so far and why?
Oh, wow. It's really difficult to say who's my favorite artist because there's so many. I think for me and for a lot of people who attend Live Oak, they're coming to see artists with the understanding that they'll have a great experience because a lot of our artists might not be that well known. Now and then we'll have a headliner that is more mainstream, and that's great. But I'm never disappointed in any act that I've seen at Live Oak, and it's a great way to get introduced to new upcoming artists or artists that don't get enough airplay traditionally. But honestly, it's a great way of just being with your friends and family and getting introduced to new artists, new genres. But yeah, almost every artist I've got to see has been my favorite. I can't really pinpoint it down to one.
Mm-hmm. Who is one artist that you want to invite?
Oh, gosh. You know, we all want to see our favorite artists, and, you know, and they're usually at the top of their game. So it's challenging. But I'll say one that would be wonderful would be Brandi Carlile. Maybe sometime in the future we'll have the opportunity. But, yeah, that would be my favorite.
I want to go back to what Greg mentioned about it doesn't matter who comes. And we hear that even if we don't have a lineup ready when tickets go on sale, people say, I don't need to know who's coming. I know it'll be good. I know there's going to be new talent that I've never heard of before, and it's going to be good, and it's always good. And so people have a trust in who's going to be performing without really knowing who's going to be performing. That's grown over the years.
So my follow-up question to both of you would be, how do you decide who to add to the lineup?
Happily, that's not something Greg and I have to worry about. The festival is booked by Good Medicine Presents, along with Marisa Waddell and Neil Losey, who also has input into it. And between them, they come up with the lineup every year. And people are always encouraged to give their opinions and recommendations. Those are often a source for bringing in new talent and not so new talent.
Another important aspect I want to make sure we bring up is the fact that we showcase a lot of local talent as well. So it's a great way to come out and sample a lot of local talent in one place in one weekend. And we love having them. And they're a big part of our lineup every year.
What has the music scene been like in San Luis Obispo County? And how has it changed over the years, Frank?
Well, in one way, it's changed over the years by growing. When I first moved here, in 1980, there weren't very many venues, there weren't very many concerts, and that has grown. And I think it's become more eclectic, and it's now a really busy, vibrant scene going on between local musicians and performers and also now venues that are bringing in all kinds of talent, internationally known, U.S. known performers as well. It's huge compared to a long time ago.
And Frank, how has your role changed over the years in terms of you were one of the first people to help organize the festival? What is it that you do now?
I kind of oversee everything in a very generic kind of way. I try not to get in people's way. If there's something that I see, then I'll help change it if it needs to be changed. But pretty much am responsible for making sure that everyone is safe, that everything is on schedule. But for the most part, I stay out of the way because the coordinators and the rest of our staff who work on this are absolutely wonderful at their jobs.
I would interject that after 36 years of putting on the festival, a lot of it sort of is on autopilot.
True.
There are years, though, like the COVID years, we had to cancel the live festival 2 years in a row. And the big move that we made when we were at Kachuma Lake and we moved back to San Luis Obispo, those are big events. And Frank is very instrumental in making sure those big changes happen. He works very hard to get people involved, get people invested again. Correct?
Yes, correct.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali. I'm talking with Frank Lanzone, KCBX's director since 1980, and Greg Perry, key organizer of the Live Oak Music Festival. It starts on June 13th, and you can buy tickets at liveoakfest.org starting January 20th. What is the one thing that you look forward to every year for the festival?
On Sunday night, whatever I'm doing, I go out and I roam around the audience area, enjoying the music and looking at all of the people who are enjoying the music and the families that are all sitting together and kids are playing and parents are moving with the music. To me, that every year, that's something that I try to do and remember it every year.
Greg, what about you?
Well, you would think that the time we look forward to is the time we finish and we get back into our own beds after the long weekend. But actually, for me, I think it's when we open the doors and start letting our patrons in, because we know we've got there, right? And people have smiles on their faces. I love going to the children's area and seeing all the kids doing their crafts. Mm-hmm. And I'm always amazed by all the smiles and how happy everyone is. So, yeah, just the kickoff, the initial kickoff is what I look forward to.
Can you tell us a little bit about the crafts area for the kids? Who came up with that? It's a great idea.
I think we've been doing it for years.
Yeah, right? Forever.
Yeah, well, we bill ourselves as really a family festival. So music and family events are family activities. So there's lots to do for kids. And over the years, people know that they can bring the entire family and there's always going to be something to do for all ages. So the kids have their own area mapped out and we have lots of volunteers that help them with their crafts or going on hikes and introducing them to the wildlife and educating them about how to take care of their environment.
Any challenges that you recall especially and how you dealt with them?
We could probably talk about the COVID years because that was very challenging and it was something we'd never done and never experienced before. And Frank would probably want to talk about that and the decisions we had to make, big decisions.
Yeah, it was a really difficult, scary time because the purpose of Live Oak ultimately is to provide income to fund the KCBX operation. And it's usually around $100,000, which is a significant amount of our budget to lose. So we had to figure out what to do with it if we couldn't have a Live Oak Music Festival. And we came up with Live Oak on the Radio, which we did for 2 years, with big shout-out and thanks to Bill Gaines Audio, because we had it in his facility. And he provided all of the engineering help, all of the space at no cost. We were able to broadcast that. And at some point, we had a special section of it where we asked for donations. It was all free. The performers who performed, they were all local, and they all performed for free. And people, well, we were just amazed at how many people called. And I think Greg and Claire Flaherty and I were in our homes taking donations over the phone because we were able to switch all of the phones to our cell phones. And that was another gratifying moment because we made significant dollars with it. But everybody I talked to had a story to tell and wow. About where they were. People were saying we were going to have our family over and have Live Oak in the backyard. And then when we heard you were doing Live Oak on the radio, we all called each other and cried and were so happy. You know, my daughter got married at Live Oak in 2018 was what somebody said, and had grown up at Live Oak. People just had stories and they wanted to tell them. It was pretty amazing. But that was, getting back to the point, that was definitely a hard, stressful time for all of us.
That actually shows so much resilience. Greg, do you want to add something?
Well, the other big event that was very challenging was moving from Live Oak Camp near Katuma Lake back to San Luis Obispo, where it really originated. So that was difficult, and Frank can explain probably better than I can why we did that.
The reason we did it was because wildfires were becoming more and more prevalent. And Live Oak Camp, close to Lake Katuma, was a fire camp for firefighters whenever there was a fire in that area. And at least once, we were afraid we weren't going to hold the Live Oak there until maybe 2 days before. And a fire had finally been controlled, and they moved out on a Saturday or Sunday, and we moved in on Monday. The firefighters moved out of Live Oak Camp.
Wow.
So,
was that like a close call? Or?
It was a close call. There were a couple of them. There were at least one time where we had to reroute getting into the camp because of a nearby fire that was smoking out some of the roads.
When was this?
Well, maybe 8 to 10 years ago.
Okay. So, Greg, how can people get involved with the festival if they're interested in volunteering?
They can visit our website, liveoakfest.org, and complete a volunteer application if they've never volunteered before. We have many volunteers. We depend on our volunteers. The festival certainly wouldn't happen without them. We have close to 600 volunteers who help us each year. And we always have new people that come on board every year, and some stay for many years. Some will just do it for 1 year. And there's something for everybody. There's working in the beer garden, or building a stage, or tearing a stage down, selling, driving a shuttle. So there's really a need for every kind of skill, because it is...
And all ages.
All ages, and it is really like building a city. So anything you can think of that you would need in a city infrastructure, we basically need at Live Oak.
Where can people buy tickets?
They can go to liveoakfest.org as well, and there will be a ticket button. And tickets go on sale the 20th of January at 10 a.m.
That was KCBX's Frank Lanzone and Greg Perry talking about the Live Oak Music Festival. You can buy tickets at liveoakfest.org starting January 20th. This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Up next, UCSB student reporter Zoha Malik talks to grad students who are part of a group called Researchers Against War.
As a group, Researchers Against War seeks to highlight and organize around, quote, the U.S. military's involvement in university research and recruitment, end quote. By researching and organizing against the university's relationship to, and what they call complicity in, the production of U.S. weapons for wars abroad, the group ultimately aims to contribute to a military-free university. I spoke with Crystal, Anam, and Hassan on their findings and what Researchers Against War is all about.
A lot of our focus has been about understanding the connections that UCSB has to both the U.S. military generally, but also very specifically to the war and genocide happening in Gaza right now. And I think that we've had different avenues of that research, whether it be understanding the research funding that flows through UCSB from the Department of Defense, from private military contractors, and how that research that is made here has impacted kind of weapons and military production in the real world. And then we are also interested in how specifically private companies who are weapons contractors, come into our career fairs and recruit UCSB students. And then another aspect that we're interested in is how research that starts here at UCSB that might be publicly funded by the DoD can get spun out through the technology office here to spin out research that is produced here into startup companies that then can use the research in weapons manufacturing. Mostly as subcontractors for some of the larger firms like Raytheon, RTX Technologies, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing. A lot of these companies have offices right here in Goleta and in Santa Barbara as well. So we're interested both in like a spatial analysis of where we sit here on the Central Coast and in relation to a larger weapons production. And then we're also interested in very specifically our role as researchers at UCSB in producing knowledge for military use.
The longstanding connection between these companies and UC Santa Barbara was not surprising to hear. Last June, Central Coast Anti-War Coalition organizer Marcy Winograd received contracts from the university from 2016 to 2021, which detailed financial relationships and deals between the school and military manufacturers such as Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon. Some of these contracts were worth millions of dollars, detailing research for technology used in warfare. UCSB's Researchers Against War states they get a lot of their information from the UC's publicly released data.
Okay, so according to UC's own data center, which is the University of California Information Center, which collects and publishes information on research and a lot of other statistics on for campus, out of the top five defense companies in the world, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, RTX, Northrop Grumman, and General Dynamics, from 2005 to 2022, UCSB has gotten the most grant money from these five corporations for research on campus for a total of around $21.9 million over these years. And that's comparable to kind of UCLA, which sits at $20.9 million, UCSD, $14.4 million. And a lot of that we found is coming from RTX Raytheon. And we've also done an analysis not only of where money, how money is coming to campus, but where money is getting invested in campus as well. And so from 2005 to 2022, according to the UC Info Center, RTX Raytheon has supplied a majority of its money, I think upwards of $8 million to the computer science department, and then a solid portion to also to engineering. And the engineering department here has gained almost $13 million over these years from these large military contracting corporations.
Researchers Against War found that between the years 2005 and 2022, 18% of all research funding at UC Santa Barbara came from military sources in that time period, and that 35% of all funding to engineering departments came from military sources, including the Department of Defense and private military contractors.
The engineering departments are focusing on robotics, microchips, and materials. That is all heavily DoD or military contractor funded. Robotics, obviously, for autonomous warfare purposes. Microchips are just one really big thing that a recent law that was passed has the DoD heavily invested in. And we have a lot of actually military contractors using our microchip lab on campus.
The recent law that Crystal is referring to is the Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors, Chips, and Science Act. Passed in 2022, this bill intends to provide about $250 billion to invest in semiconductor research and development. It has been used to serve these aims on campus. In late 2023, UCSB joined the California Defense Ready Electronic and Micro Devices Superhub, California Dreams, sponsored by the Department of Defense. Since then, California Dreams has received over $260 million in funding from the CHIPS Act to do this very research. Hassan, tell me about what specifically these materials can be and have been used for.
Some of the materials that labs here on campus are making, these are materials that can still perform in the same way that current aerospace alloys, for example, are utilized, but are perhaps more cost-effective, they're lighter, easier to manufacture. And so there are actually a lot of close collaborations between labs on this campus with companies like Pratt & Whitney, for example, that manufactures F-35 gas turbine engines, as well as General Electric. And just for some numbers, you know, in 2019, Pratt & Whitney completed 134 F-35 fighter jets. The U.S. government objective at that time was over 2,400. And this number has just grown recently. We see that 25 F-35 jets have been sold to Israel. And these jets are being integrated with these dumb bombs, these like 2,000-pound Vietnam-era bombs that are being dropped on civilian structures in Gaza. And so labs here on campus are generating novel materials. They call them ceramic matrix composites that are the Air Force has announced will save a lot of cost and manufacturing time in the production of these Air Force jets. That's just one example. Another example is some of the alloys that are utilized are using cobalt. So something, I think the majority of cobalt that's brought into the U.S. is utilized in military aircraft applications. And these are used, again, in jet engine parts. They're used in the tail. They're now being used to coat jets to provide them more stealth-like capabilities and avoid detection on radar. And so there are labs here that are innovating cobalt alloys for these kinds of purposes.
The NanoFab Lab on campus, according to its website, is a, quote, research fabrication facility for micro and nanoscale processing, end quote, and, quote, provides supplies, facilities, equipment, and know-how needed to accomplish your cutting-edge research, end quote. Meaning the facility can be rented out for a variety of research purposes. Anam explains what this can look like.
This NanoFab is like a chip manufacturing fabrication, like state-of-the-art clean room that we have on campus that is owned by UCSB. And in order to gain funds, basically it leases out space technology and expertise to private companies, and in a lot of cases, private military companies, to come in and use the public resource here at UCSB for their private ends and means and profits.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Zuha Malik is a reporter for KCSB, the student radio station at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She is talking to grad students who are part of a group called Researchers Against War.
The group's research process involves identifying and highlighting research on campus that takes Department of Defense or military contractor funding.
We've got sort of two broad categories, which is the grants that DOD or military contractors have with specific PIs or labs on campus. And we were able to get this information both from the UCSB side, which I believe they have taken down, but we got that before it was taken down, and the DOD side, who, you know, they still have all their grants up, and we can see that which ones are with UCSB. So we've actually gotten that information and we have compiled it, but there is a lot to go through. So we're just getting started with that. And then the second part is kind of directly identifying which PIs on campus are taking DOD funding or military contractor funding, which that specifically is not going to be listed with the DOD.
And then I think the point of the research that we're doing is that we're trying to show not only that UCSB is complicit in weapons manufacturing and in the US and Israel supported genocide, but that we as researchers, we as graduate students, we as graduate workers have a role to play in this complicity, and that we have a power to potentially hopefully cut these or to like start to cut these ties between UCSB and the military. And that that actually the research that we do, even though it's labeled as basic science, is of course still applicable in some sense. And so there's a lot of workers who work on maybe small scientific problems in materials or engineering that are not sure exactly how their project might be applied in Hassan's example of like the F-35 fighter jet, but that we are trying to show that, like, first, that these connections very much exist, and then second, that you and we as researchers and workers have the power to throw a wrench in these gears of war. And I think that, I don't know, just speak to one of the things that we've also worked on last year during the strike that was in response to the UC's violent and police repression of protesters at UCLA, at Irvine, at San Diego, at Santa Cruz, and also here at UCSB. that we are part of our demand in that strike, and a demand that we as Researchers Against War support is a demand for the UC to make free transitional funding for STEM researchers. And this transitional funding demand would mean that if research workers, if graduate students are put by their PI or lab or department under a DoD grant or a private military grant, even that first, that they have the right to know that. And then second, that they are able to apply for transitional funding to hopefully, if they would like that, to transition out of the DoD funding and private military funding into a different funding source that might be more amenable to them.
The three grad students stress the bigger picture of research done on campus.
Yeah, the Department of Defense, from their basic research directorate, their number one goal is paradigm-shifting basic research that may lead to enhanced warfighter capabilities and strategic and tactical advantage, which is what Anam had referred to. So even the really basic research, as far as it might seem from a military application, it can still be utilized. And another, like, I think really useful historic example to keep in mind, back in the 40s, I believe, maybe even before the 40s, there was a plant physiologist named Arthur Galston at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And he was working on a DOD-funded project to accelerate soybean growth and flowering. And he discovered some agent that, when applied in excess, caused these flowers to defoliate and lose their leaves. And later in the 50s, during the Vietnam War, these chemicals were used, and we now know them as Agent Orange.
UCSB Researchers Against War is also in the process of producing a project regarding the historic relationship between UC Santa Barbara and the military industry in Goleta. This is set to be released at the beginning of 2025. With KCSB News, I'm Zoha Malik. Thank you for listening.
Up next is a special one from our archives. The National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis stands at the site of the Lorraine Motel, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. KCBX's Tom Wilmer traveled there and spoke to Faith Morris, External Affairs Officer, about the importance of educating people on history.
Some folks said that, yeah, the devil's dead. The devil's dead. No, some folks said that.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Memphis, Tennessee. Right now we're here with Faith Morris at the
National Civil Rights Museum.
Yeah.
Yes. It opened in 1991, and in 2014 we did a major renovation to really expand on the story. The museum was a phenomenal institution all along, but we wanted to make it more immersive. We also wanted to make sure that slavery was the first experience, because we really felt that slavery was the early instance of civil rights infringements. And this exhibit really does tell the story of a culture of resistance, the story of slavery from 1619 to 1861. We wanted to make sure that folks really got how treacherous the voyage was from that middle passage over to America. So we have a little trails on the floor so that you could track what was going on as slaves were brought over.
You obviously have a lot of school groups
always,
that come here.
Always have a museum full of young people.
In which ways does it become most palpable and real for these kids that come here? The slavery and the transportation.
The history books don't go into enough detail.
Wow.
You know, it's so top-lined if it's talked about at all. The areas that really need to be focused on, the ones that were most transformed, were the ones that really changed this country and really led to changes in the world. Yes, they've heard of slavery. I can't say it's just the kids. We have plenty of adults that are saying, wow, I had no idea. And that's why we spent so much time in this first exhibit, to really help folks understand that slavery lasted so long because it was the backbone of the country. If you didn't have slavery, the whole economy would fall. The slaves built commerce during that time. So they held on to it as long as they could, because they needed to have an alternative to get that work done, right? And it also
also, folks really don't understand that it lasted 366 years. Almost 13 million Africans brought across the Atlantic Ocean, and it was the largest forced slave movement in the world.
What are the things that most get them and that they connect with?
When they come in here, and we left that little space behind, you know, so they could crouch down and see how uncomfortable it was. And they said, wow, I just don't know. And then we tell them to listen to the voices of the slaves, and you could hear the anguish and the tears and the sadness, but you could also hear that there was a communication that they had. This was the beginning of this whole music and chanting that went through the centuries of, you know, being able to communicate in a way that only they understood, so that their masters didn't know what they were talking about. And then also to help them understand slave trade and how the families were torn apart, how babies almost first born were taken away from their moms, how husbands and wives didn't get to spend much of their lives together if they got to spend any of it together again after they were separated, and how brutal it was, and how amazing that any of them got through it. They were not allowed to read. They didn't want them to talk and communicate, because they did understand that there's power of connection. And so they really kept them as part, they kept them at odds, they kept them fighting, you know. And they persevered through all of that. They snuck and they read and they created their own languages. And they stripped them of their names, you know, so that they would have nothing that was of their former life before they got here. And that they reclaimed so much of that. And because of that, those that could grew stronger.
Even in more recent history, you know, 1800s, mm-hmm. there were some slaves that became incredible leaders and brilliant educators. Talk to us about some of your favorite characters.
Well, let me tell you, Harriet Tubman is my absolute favorite. Harriet Tubman is the mama and the leader of all of the slavery movement. She created this underground railroad, and you know, you have to explain to folks that it's not a train, you know. It truly was a movement that took slaves from house to house, places underground in holes, you know, wherever they could get some safety.
You've read a lot about her. Do you have that feeling that you know her?
Oh, I think I know her and I love her. There's one statement that she said that actually transcends some of what I think about today is, I freed thousands of slaves, mm-hmm. but I could have freed thousands more if they knew they were slaves. She was a very smart woman. Mm-hmm. She had to be brilliant to do what she did in the first place, and very brave to do what she did.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear her voice, feel her sense of personality?
I can. I get so involved in trying to understand what was in their head at the time to see what in the world would I do. Would I have been able to endure any of it? And, you know, I think I'm a fighter, but I don't know if I could fight that hard. That's hard work, and you have to be fairly fearless. This woman was capital F fearless, you know. She went against everything that was going against her to free, to make the decision not just to get herself out, because clearly she was smart enough to do that.
It goes without saying that she was a threat to certain people too.
She was a threat to all of those that wanted to keep slavery intact.
So it's amazing that she wasn't killed.
It is amazing, but she carried a shotgun, so she wasn't afraid to shoot anybody who came. She was as treacherous as the slave masters.
Wow.
Just for the other side.
Tough critter.
Right.
Yeah. When I was with you last time, you mentioned something about lynching.
Yes.
You said lynching still goes on today.
There are recent stories now. Mm-hmm. There are stories of blacks that, and well, people of color. I don't know that I can say that it's exclusive to just blacks now. Mm-hmm. But folks are using that still as a way of hushing a community, of giving a threat that, you know, I need you to stay in your place. The whole lynching thing, if you'll notice that slavery has come back so folks can understand better what that is, because it explains a lot of what's happening now, why people do and feel the way they do. And then lynching, the story of lynching and understanding lynching has become a huge, huge, huge topic because of how inhumane as slavery was, and I still think is the most treacherous, lynching was almost entertainment, that they would hang a young man or a young woman or an old man or old woman or a child. It was as if they were going to the movie. God, we got a lynching today. Folks got excited, and the word went through the community of, you know, just, wow, isn't that good? You know, and they sat there and they watched that person wrench and rug until they died, hanging from, you know, and then they went on. They left him hanging there. Yeah. They didn't pull him down, you know, to have some kind of dignity in death. So understanding what kind of mind would do what they did during slavery and do what they've done through lynching, and I'm saying that lynching still exists.
It takes a different form. But
it's not a party anymore. Right. It's a sneaking around and doing it.
But even pretty blunt and blatant, I mean, driving while black.
All of that.
I mean, that's
all
unbelievable.
That. There's a significant target on especially black men, and it's a way, almost the way it was in slavery, almost the way it has been through war, where you tear the male influence away. And as strong as women are, and frankly, I think we can do anything, but to not have a total family unit is not the best way for young people to get a sense of what family is, although there's loving and, you know, lots of sisters and aunties and grandma and all of that. But it's an intentional way of not having what's considered normal.
Let's go to one of your favorite areas.
This actually is one of my, other than slavery, because I think slavery is absolutely a favorite of mine. But this combating Jim Crow is something. I can't tell you how many folks say, now who was Jim Crow?
Right.
And we say, no, Jim Crow was not a person. It was oppressive laws. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, during Reconstruction, there were some strides that were made. You know, it was amazing to come from slavery. And then, you know, after that, anybody had the gumption to try to open a school or become a lawyer or a doctor or do some black media.
That was a threat.
That was a threat. Mm-hmm. So along came Jim Crow to shut all that down. And so the images in this exhibit, where we have to be reminded of what the Klan meant then and now. The Klan has not gone anywhere. They just are wearing suits and ties. Mm-hmm. They have actually gotten back in some instances to their regalia.
Putting the hoods and the sheets on.
Yeah, to start doing it because they're very proud. They used to hide. Now, it's okay to show hate. It's okay to have symbols of hate.
They've actually been encouraged by certain people.
They have.
Yeah.
No need to hide. You're a strong force. Mm-hmm. You know, do what you do. Yeah. And they're doing what they do. The issue is that now they're infiltrating our police and fire and doctors, and, you know, we're surrounded in different ways.
Yeah.
And this one that just talks about how folks were owning their own land and, you know, shaping the future. And then I get, it's like this, a stop. And I see this about what happens when folks try to vote.
Mm-hmm.
How deadly it was to even let folks know that you were trying to register to vote. We're going to get to one of my favorites as we go through, Fannie Lou Hamer, who after Harriet Tubman is Fannie Lou.
It's hard to look at.
It is hard to look at. But it's absolutely what was going on. And this is not an isolated incident.
And that's not that horribly long ago in history.
I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. No.
And it's still going on today.
It is absolutely going on today. That's what is so frightening and dangerous about what's happening in society, is that some of the worst of our history is coming back in full force.
And what are these photos about right here? Is that Dubois right there?
No, that's Booker T. Washington.
Oh, yeah, Booker T., yeah.
Up there.
And then he's with Roosevelt?
See, Booker T. Washington was the one who says, y'all need to stop all this fighting and go to school. You need to be educated. Don't be ignorant so that you can know what's right and wrong from a mental standpoint. Mm-hmm. W.B. Dubois said, we need to fight. Frederick Douglass, we need to fight. they didn't believe in that. They thought Booker T. Washington was bougie, you know, what we call bougie now, that he was an elitist, that he didn't put his feet on the ground and work, you know, against the movement, that he was too soft, too heavily educated and pushing, you know, a soft science instead of fighting back.
Yeah, that would be like Malcolm X, that same.
Malcolm and Martin, absolutely. But what's interesting, though, is, you know, Malcolm was an eye for an eye. He truly believed in that, you know, by any means necessary. If that meant violence and brutality, do it. If that's what it takes to get it, do it.
Right.
And, of course, Dr. King was nonviolent. Well, they kind of switched places as they got older. Dr. King was tired of being nice. You know, he was an orator, a great preacher. Mm-hmm. He had gone through everything. He had gone through two presidents. He had gotten the civil rights movement done. He had gotten the voting rights movement done. He had worked hard to get that. But toward the end, he had lost his supporters. Mm-hmm. The organizations that had been behind him were not with him, because he dared to talk about Vietnam. And so government turned on him in a different way, because as slavery was the backbone of the economy then, war has always been a big economic push.
So being anti-war, he became a major
threat. It turned a corner when he became anti-war. And what he said was he understood war, but not how war was used to tear the black family apart and how war was used to kill these boys over there when they were fighting for a country who didn't fight for them. And it wasn't a fair position. And we outnumbered, you know, we were disproportionately recruited, not even recruited, mandated to show
drafted,
up.
Drafted. And then the middle-class white boys all had their deferments.
All kinds of excuses, all kinds of ways, the safety net.
Tell me about this photo here. It's a photo of a parade, looks like maybe 1920s, and there's a large sign, "The New Negro Has No Fear." Where is this? What was happening?
I'm not sure where this is, actually, but what it is, it's representative of what was going on during this time, though.
But that's some pretty gutsy action right there.
But there was a lot of that going on. Mm-hmm. It happened in the South. Mm-hmm. It happened in the North. Was a pushback in the South.
That's in the height of the lynching
era
they were talking about, and yet these people had the guts to stand proud in the middle of a giant parade.
Well, they made their own parade. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the movement did was we used signage in a way that hadn't been used anywhere. If you look at all of these images, you see that we tell you exactly what we're fighting for, exactly what's on our mind. You don't have to try to figure it out. Dr. King's frustration was, you know, the civil rights movement was the most successful in that it included legislation and litigation. No problem going to court. Let's get a bill that supports it. Let's get the highest in the land, the president, to understand
what's going
on.
What you're talking about is the 1960s, which was a really profound decade
in
movement, and there really hasn't been any period of time since then quite as intense.
No. It was the most violent movement. We still don't know how many people were killed in the movement, because a lot of it wasn't documented, you know. And until Dr. King came along, and this is why he is such a smart man, he wanted to make sure that media started capturing some of this, because all this violence and terrorism was going on just in the neighborhoods. You know, so all the folks knew about it were the folks that were around it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't get outside that small area.
So that really, of all things, was the game changer.
That exactly.
Is finding that way to get it on the national news and get the word out.
Yeah. In Montgomery, and, you know, folks need to understand how powerful women were in Montgomery. It was the most successful economic boycott that there was. They shut down the Montgomery transit system.
Why did it happen in Montgomery, Alabama? Is there any explanation?
Why Montgomery?
Yeah.
It's because you just had some women in Montgomery that just wasn't going to take it. You know, mad as hell ain't going to take it anymore. Well, issue was all over. The NAACP in Montgomery apparently was very strong. Rosa Parks, I mean, this whole wall is talking about how Rosa was not the first one mm-hmm. to not give up her seat, but she was the most validated one mm-hmm. to give up her seat. She was an officer in the NAACP. She was a secretary. She was an intelligent woman. She was well-respected. She wasn't a child. Some of them were young. Mm-hmm. Some of them, you know, didn't have position in the community, and she did. And so the day she decided not to was the day that this really got the news. And this is also in Montgomery is when Dr. King was brought to town. And he was brought to town because they said, we need somebody new. Because mm-hmm. they're not respecting these folks. It ain't gonna right. do it. They're not gonna change anything based on what they're saying. Yeah, we got Rosa, and that was a smart thing. But we gotta get somebody in here that can move this thing along.
But what's interesting about that brain trust and those people at that point in time, what they figured out was their economic power.
Oh,
right?
They figured it out.
Yeah.
They walked, they took their babies, they walked to mm-hmm. work, they walked to church, they walked their children to school. I love these statues in here because it shows these women doing their thing, showing how I'm sure they would love to sit down and take a ride.
But that being said, and it being so palpably clear at that time and place, mm-hmm. I guess my question would be, why isn't there more strategizing today of that potential economic power of influence by boycott, etc.?
That is a million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is.
That's an interesting question because you have folks not any less mad now mm-hmm. than they were then. But I'll say we've gone a little soft in that these folks gave up everything to do what they needed to do. You know, we don't necessarily give up everything. Mm-hmm.
So there's just enough of kind of those comfort things to make it.
I'm going to take you to something that's going on in fashion where you have, you know, Gucci doing blackface. You have another one doing a noose that's a necklace. And folks have said, you know, folks were pissed. They were just really infuriated about it. Mm-hmm. And then you got something that says, sure, I'm wearing my stuff. Well, now what kind of sense does that make? That they have totally shown disrespect mm-hmm. for what has been an issue and gonna make light of it through fashion. And we still don't give up on that? Now, we had lots of angry voices. I know I put my stuff up, I got plenty of it, mm-hmm. but I will not be treated like that. But if as many of us stop doing, because we disproportionately spend, most of these brands build their business on black shoppers.
Well, I could hug you all morning, but I think I gotta let you go.
Okay.
But Faith Morris, thank you so much for sharing. This has been a touching morning once again.
Yeah, it's great to see you again.
I know.
Your memory is amazing. And I'm glad that you're doing this. We really appreciate that you continue to be interested in the museum and to share what we're doing here.
It's my pleasure and my honor. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Memphis, Tennessee.
And cornbread and butter beans and you cross the table.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.